You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 52, where we continue to discuss revised edition of Rosemary Stewart's book, Managers and Their Jobs, a study of the similarities and differences in the ways managers spend their time. In part two, we're going to talk about organizational management issues related to the text, particularly current events and trends. And we're also going to look at the connection between industry and the literature and current phenomenon. And I think particularly in the text, she addresses some key features of how to apply this work or how to apply the research in chapters 7 and 8, which I think are really set up very well by the earlier analysis. And by the way, for our listeners, the summaries of the chapters are wonderful. So they really do set up the chapter 7 and 8. And I think in chapter 7 and 8, though, you can't rely on the summaries. You really have to get in the details of the chapters, because that's the heart of the book. And certainly chapter 9 as well, where she talks about how do you apply this knowledge, which I particularly liked, because you see a lot of management research and research on leaders says, okay, we gained all these insights, so do these things. And her approach in chapter 9 was more about how to help yourself. What can you do to help yourself? Which I thought was really insightful and a good way to write the text.
Yeah, what I'd like to offer as a way of starting is we can start with chapter 8, which was what do managers do? It's essentially a summary of the findings of the study. And just looking over the different characteristics that she explains about how managers behave, what their environment is, et cetera, it'd be just kind of interesting to, you know, how accurate or how accurate do we think that these are in describing, say, managers' life in 2018? I looked at the list, I'll just highlight one that's really fascinating to me was the idea of not being in control. 1967, wouldn't probably understand that the belief in the managers really being the kings and queens of their realms was probably rather prevalent. Nowadays, I think there's perhaps a bit better understanding that managers have to swim with the tide sometimes. So I'm just kind of thinking, you know, what do we all think about how well Chapter 8 describes, you know, manager life today and what has changed?
Well, maybe I can jump in. It's really interesting, and I think it's a wonderful way, a place to start. And I think the control bit, you're absolutely right. Davide Nicolini always talks about this as sort of Nelson on a horse or head of a ship, and a type of a kind of visionary great man leader type of idea we have of managers as being in sort of omniscient and always in control. And I think you're absolutely right. Hopefully, we will all have grown out of that to talk about it that way. That's probably but as we also know, that's absolutely not the case. The great man, you know, I was teaching a couple of weeks ago to my undergraduate finalists, and you know, the sort of, just if you look at the tech sector today, the idea of these sort of great man leaders who then, you know, with one fell swoop can get us to the moon or to Mars, you know, is still there, this idea of perfect control, particularly for executives. And I think it's not explicit. I don't think anybody in the scholarly literature would be quite so, foolish to believe that. But I think what is interesting is that despite this, we have a related problem, which is a related problem of accountability, which is particularly if you're a chief executive, you're, you know, contractually and in the court of public opinion, responsible and accountable for being in control, or if not being in control, knowing what's going on so that you can in some way shape your organization. And I always use this example of a couple of years ago. There was a famous FT, and Pedro will know, David and Nicolini and I did a piece of research on this in MIT Sloan Review a couple of years ago about how CEOs stay in the know, right? How do they know what's going on in their organizations? And this was used and as part of a piece, and the piece actually mentioned at the time HSBC chief executives kind of in front of, I think it was the House of Commons sort of parliamentary committee, being asked about a recent scandal at the time in a different branch abroad, and was asked, you know, how could it, you know, why didn't you do something about this, right? It's clearly wrong. And he said, how can I be expected to know what 330,000 people are doing, right? And curiously enough, Henry Mintzberg is cited in that piece saying that's a ridiculous defense, right? That's a silly defense. You are paid to know. That was sort of, I'm summarizing kind of his argument, right? But I think what's really interesting, just going back to this, is that this idea that, you know, Rosemary tells us very clearly they're not in control. She also tells us very clearly that, you know, their work is fragmented. They're largely overworking. They are, you know, kind of very superficial in their approach to information. They just kind of skim. They work a lot with sort of random signals and a little bit of noise. They develop habits which are not necessarily always appropriate to the job itself, right? She tells us about all these things. And then yet I think, you know, she also says that sometimes managers also cling to certain kinds of illusions. She calls them mistaken beliefs about, you know, what they're doing, how they're doing it, that things aren't quite as bad, bad being sort of in what they imagine.
Well, something I think that was particularly relevant was this, something you touched on, Maya, that's also in this chapter in the section on temptations and inefficiency, this risk of superficial responses to problems and not distinguishing between issues that require special attention. I've done a lot of study of crisis and organizational disasters and how they develop. And in almost all cases, there are signs. I mean, perhaps there were an HSBC case. But you have to have two things. You have to have methods or processes within the organization that identify what some of these signs might be, or you might call them warning lights or indicators or something. So if you don't have management processes that will highlight some of them to actually bring them to management's attention, which I do believe, by the way, is a key management function. You know, what should those processes be? But if you don't have that, you're not even going to be aware of it. So I think, like you said, I think it's a dodge to say, oh, I can't know what's going on in my organization. Okay, that could be so. And then the other feature of what Stuart really emphasizes is, and you see this in the questions that she suggests managers ask themselves, and that is, should I have paid more attention to this? Why didn't I pay more attention? And she's not necessarily talking about the crisis level, but she helps managers ask those kinds of questions or suggest that they ask them to themselves. And I thought that was really interesting, the notion that she's suggesting you need to have more awareness of situations that require special attention, where you will slow down in the stream of things and say, no, I need more information about that, or we need to follow up. And not necessarily that the senior manager does all the work, but they play a key role in identifying, hey, this is something we need to pay more attention to. And I saw that over and over again when I was in management practice.
Yeah. Now there's the downside of that, in that you could potentially end up setting up structures that are designed to keep you fully informed of just about everything, to the point where it sort of reinforces the superficiality and reinforces the lack of control. And I'm just going to offer sort of an example that in a number of places in which I worked, the boss, the commander, or the leader of the organization, one of the emphasis was make sure that he gets all of the information of what's been written about the organization in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, all of that sort of thing. So that is the beginning of the day. Yeah, they're armed with what they could possibly be called about in the course of the day, if you catch my meaning. Like, what is the press going to call me about? And it becomes a real, you know, significant time sink to be able to try to stay ahead of the boss doing that, in thinking of all of the things in which could possibly happen. And you start to wonder at that point, do they cease being proactive or do they wind up reinforcing this problem of superficiality?
That's a great point, because I've seen organizations where it's all about funneling everything to the boss. So I think the devil is in the details about how you do that, Tom. And so you bring up an important caveat, because then it becomes a large fraction of people's jobs is to get all this information to the boss. And it's a race in some. I've been in organizations where it was a race to get information to the boss, and he couldn't provide it in context, and all sorts of difficult things would occur as a result of that. And in the military for many years, we had this thing called the early bird, which was exactly what Tom described. It was some large organizations, or they got bigger and bigger over time, scouring the press across the United States for any mention of something in the Department of Defense or some hint of scandal or something. And I do agree that becomes counterproductive after a while.
I think it's really interesting because, you know, you're both raising an interesting point about, you know, what are the sort of inefficiencies that are created largely through, in some cases, perhaps it was a good intention, and then it grew into something that becomes just horribly inefficient and creates sort of second order inefficiencies down the line. It creates perverse incentives and it clouds judgments as well. And I think it's really valuable as well about particularly the last two chapters of this book, but also sort of Rosemary's opus more broadly, is that she very much kind of in a very direct sense tells people, look, some of this might be you. Some of this might be your own preferences. And if I could, I just want to read, because I highlighted and I thought it was so, again, poignant and to the point, and we could have been reading it in HBR literally this year. So it's page 130 on fragmentation, right? And it says, the reasons for unnecessary fragmentation of the working day may be your method of working or other people's. This is where she gets punchy. It is hard to admit to oneself that a fragmented day is often the laziest day, the day that demands the least in terms of mental discipline, though the most in nervous energy. It is easier to pass from one subject to a second when the first requires a difficult or unpalatable decision or sustained thought. It is easier to respond to each fresh stimulus, to hear after the latest query, than to set an order of priorities and try to keep to it. This, of course, includes knowing when the latest query has priority. It is easier to be a grasshopper jumping from one problem to another than a beaver chewing away at a tough task. And I think
that's a great quote. That's a great point.
It reveals so much. And again, what's common today, but also links wider. Mensmore talks about this. He talks about what we call the action orientation of managers. Kotcher has described that for leaders as well in his general managers. And honestly, it's really interesting because it's such a powerful way, I think, also to combine some of the things that we've been talking about, but in a way that kind of says, look, because you might also have certain personal preferences, but also because the nature of your job might just be so overwhelming that getting anything done becomes something that we get a bit of a sort of, a kick on our hormones. So we feel
almost a buzz. Yes, it's like a buzz people get.
And
yes.
So actually, this then perpetuates this kind of not just you engaging your diary and your work in a way that suits you and your preferences and gives you quick wins, right? A little bit of hits of a positive feeling. But also, and this is the danger, particularly at chief executive level, it frames the work patterns of other people around you so that you get what when you were describing, you know, you get patterns of behavior around you that feed the beast in the way that suits a very perverse set of preferences when it comes to work. Perverse in the sense that it's not necessarily the most efficient. It is just feel comfortable with and what helps you deal with that sort of challenging sense of your work. And I think this problem, I'm calling it the grasshopper problem, is a particular one that is really, really, really challenging. Because if we link it to, for instance, Keith Grint's work on leadership, Keith talks about the fact that leaders also frame certain situations. So Ralph, you were talking about extreme settings. So in extreme settings, he says that that's sort of crisis mode, right? So if something mode and leaders are able to frame it as a crisis, then a sort of command approach in which they're at the fore, in which they're that kind of Nelson on a horse type of a figure, you know, reacting is appropriate. But if they frame something as a leadership question, which is what you need when you're in a sort of high reliability organization or in a learning kind of a setting, then they can bring in much more of that sort of leaderly asking questions, bringing other experts together.
Maya, that's a great point, yeah. And I often found it was important to be explicit as a leader of something I wanted to be a high reliability organization about the behavior I expected in crises. I would tell the people that work with me, look, when there's a crisis, I expect you to act. Don't wait for me to tell you what to do. And when I come into the room, if you're already in charge or the thing's already going on, you need to find a good spot to stop, you know, when there's time to tell me, but I don't expect you to stop the moment I come in the room, because I'm coming in to observe how you're doing, not whether you're giving me all information so I can make all the choices. And the people I work with, they were very comfortable with that, but I found my bosses were not so comfortable, because they would see me come in and they expected me to take charge. And I said, no, that's not how I'm developing my people. So it's interesting. My subordinates could respond that very well, but my superiors could not. Pedro, you had a comment you wanted to reflect too?
Yes, and I think your example is very interesting because it reveals some of what I was thinking. It seems that a lot of that has to do with Maya was referring to Rosemary's idea of the grasshopper, but actually I feel that buried here is somehow the idea of this very more macho kind of management. This idea that there is, you know, someone is always going to save the day, is going to put the fire, is going to deal with the crisis, and that management is all about that. And the organizations that I've studied that are interestingly reflect this kind of a very masculine, kind of very kind of, you know, the people that tend to get promoted are the ones that are handling the fires, not necessarily the ones that take time to do the planning and so on and so forth, illustrate that. And I think your example of what you're referring, which is about giving autonomy to people and let people to think and reflect, not only portraying yourself as the one that is going to solve the issues, get at the heart of that. That may be one of the reasons why we still have that idea of managers as the ones that are, to quote, you know, in this, like, in the horse come to save, is because it is linked to bigger ideas on, like, these hero-like ideas that are still being reproduced in a number of publications about management, and which are also tied to, you know, almost like gendered patterns to speak. And I think the work of Rosemary is very powerful because it manages to showcase that what we do is shaped by structure. She goes at length to talk about how specific patterns reflect the nature of the position and the job types. But at the same time, she gives agency not in a way to say, oh yes, you can do whatever things that you want, but as we were saying in the last part, by showcasing that reflection is possible. And through reflection, we can rethink things and do differently without falling on the idea of the heroism or anything like that.
Yeah, but we also have to be careful that, you know, there's a other phenomena that I think are a little bit more recent that play into this as well. And that's where organizations reacting to others' crises in the wrong way. So like medicine as a metaphor, you know, how the legal disclaimers on the bottles of medicine have grown in length because of all of the potential liabilities and those sorts of things. A lot of what the managers, you know, a lot of this additional information requirements and the structures, it's all been based on, not all been based on, let me rephrase that. It has been influenced by witnessing what other organizations have had to endure in their crises. And so they're also trying to protect themselves from it. So the heroism plays a little bit into it, but it's also a bit of a defensive mechanism is my take.
I wanted to build upon this point of superficiality because I found it quite interesting. I also found it was a bit of a shame that it's treated in chapter 7, I think, in a bit of a brief manner, when I think there's, and our conversation has actually proved it, there's quite a lot to say. And the point that I wanted to pick up was a bit more, as mentioned previously, of framing. So we have this idea that superficiality, or in any case, some sort of speedy decision-making, some sort of quick response, is actually bad in some cases, but good in others. And this is, I think, what the author tries to pick up upon by distinguishing between different kinds of issues. And we've talked about moments of crisis, but also moments that require a bit more of a collection of information to be able to make that decision. And it comes to mind that when we look at this idea of entrepreneurs, we also have a lot of framing around heroes and so on, and everything is fine when the entrepreneur has made a great decision, has spotted an opportunity or has exploited an opportunity, and this is justified based on concepts such as intuition. And I think that is quite fascinating, because we play around with the same ideas, but then they are tweaked in different manners depending on the context of the decision-making context.
I think the superficiality aspect is really, really interesting. And as Miranda was saying, also in a different way, can be connected to other different things. I think what I really like actually as a connection is, in particular, again, she kind of says to people, and this is the last chapter when she says, right, you're running out of time. You feel like you have too little time. Can you do anything about it? Right. And what she does is, in a really interesting way, she just kind of says, look, some of what you, again, bringing it back to this idea of being indispensable, you don't need to know everything. You don't need to be everywhere. To Ralph's point, you don't need to be leading. Now, somebody might expect you to do that, but you don't need that, right? There's a variety in which that's appropriate or not. And again, what was really interesting to me, and I mentioned before this Michael Porter and Nitin Noria piece, How CEOs Manage Time in HBR, in July this year, right? In July, August issue, is they exactly go through this, and they just make the link to email. And sent email facilitates just being constantly on and kind of knowing a little tiny bit about everything. And then it becomes this kind of, and so they say, this is why setting proper expectations and norms for what email the CEO needs to receive and when he or she will respond is essential. Because it's basically avoid this idea of, constantly bombarded and then you can't deal, then you're superficial, but then actually some variety then gets lost. So it's kind of, again, we go back to her identifying in really nice ways, I think, around these different topics, both really the balancing acts that one needs to do to get to what might be appropriate in that context. There is no universal no-no. She's not saying superficiality is necessarily bad. What she's saying is partly it might be a part of how you've set up your job and your expectations, and you may want to reflect on whether or not that is still appropriate, which incidentally is also something that Davide Nicolini and I, in that MIT Management Sloan piece, that's almost identically the lesson we got to in a very different path, doing a slightly different research, how many years later. So again, timeliness is really...
Well, and one of the things I'd like to close us out with in this session, not right away, because I think we have some good things to discuss, is the ideas that she presents for organizing the work to improve efficiency, because I think that was really creative and interesting outgrowth of the research that she did. So we've talked about the fragmentation, and Maya had that excellent quote that suggested it may come from your method of working or that of others, and you need to think about that. And then she offers several other points that I thought were very interesting, such as, and it was just discussed in email when we were talking about communications, clarity and brevity. And I will tell you, as having been a former senior leader in the Navy, that used to drive me crazy when people would just wander around in email or some letter and take forever to get to the point. So I was a big stickler for clarity and brevity in communications, to be clear and get the information across, but not spend a bunch of time on secondary or tertiary issues so you lose time trying to understand what the key issue was. And she does suggest that there are things that people can do to, or managers can do, to reduce time lost in traveling. So she does return to that. And so perhaps it's not inevitable that you would lose time in your job traveling if you can find ways to make good use of the time. And it's perhaps a possibility of the research that people just didn't report what they were thinking about when they were traveling. And then another recommendation that I thought was really interesting, and particularly for when this was written, because it was so far ahead of its time, the notion that you needed to account for natural body rhythms for when you decide to do what. So I don't know if that necessarily gets into the detail of circadian rhythm, but this idea that you're more productive at some times than others, and perhaps working till 10 or 11 o'clock at night, you're not your most productive. And so there's different kinds of work you should be doing at different times. I thought that was very insightful. And then two more to go. One was this thinking, you know, trying to avoid stale or stereotypical responses to issues, which we've discussed briefly, but it's kind of easier said than done. But when you have some kind of time analysis or review of your own schedule, and you try to make yourself less of a slave to your schedule, you've got a shot of doing that when you're trying to prioritize what the most important issues are. And then lastly, one of the things I thought was really, it was a great way to finish up the book, was this idea that you're really in charge of developing yourself, this self-development that you need to take charge of. And she strongly encourages leaders and managers to be asking what you've learned recently, which I thought was really interesting, because otherwise, you know, you could be this grasshopper jumping around from, you know, bit to bit, and you get this adrenaline rush and this psychic thrill from being the person in charge and being indispensable. But it actually takes quite a bit of an intestinal fortitude to ask yourself, what are you learning, or what aren't you learning?
Absolutely. And I think this is the really wonderful thing. As I said a little while ago, this notion of reflection for her, it was very much there, but also the kind of cyclicality of work. She talks about this as well. And she recognizes as well that jobs change over time. So I mentioned that later on, she moves into this kind of trifecta of demands, constraints, and choices. You know, all of these things change over time as well. And this is why for her, reflection was that important. And just to give one example, you know, you nicely kind of gave practical examples from that chapter, Ralph, but this is the one that really kind of struck with me in terms of that self-development piece is, again, we've mentioned this a little bit already, but this kind of question of, what do I need to know? Right? What do I need to know for what my demands are? And in particular, she kind of said, you need to ask yourself three questions. Did I need to be concerned with it at all, with this issue? Did I need to be concerned at that stage? And did I need to be involved in so much detail? So for me, I was kind of taking notes, and it was something about ownership. So do you need to own that item? Secondly, timeliness. Is this the right time for you to be a part of that? As you were saying, you know, Ralph, earlier, in certain kinds of situations, if your team are handling it, you don't need to be stepping in at that point, right? You just need to report when there's room for that. And then the third factor is the nature of your involvement, right? Do you take a step back? Are you there forward? Are you driving that? Or are you not? And I think, again, it's almost, I think what's really, not to be critical, but I think when you read that chapter, I think the small diary extensions that she develops to facilitate this kind of reflection, I actually found not to be that useful. But I think the actual text, in terms of what she was trying to get you to reflect on.
Yeah, that was the best part. I think the diary, you could take or leave that for the reasons you just stated, but it's those questions that are really important. And you know, you may diary or you may not over those kinds of things, but that reflection is essential to getting better as a leader.
What I found fascinating, though, was that when I think about the number of times in which my organization had to do some sort of a work survey in order to determine whether we needed more personnel or needed to contract something, whatever, the diaries actually pretty closely mirror the type of data that we had to collect. So I wouldn't dismiss the diaries entirely, maybe not for the purposes of understanding managerial, you know, for manager's individual development and self-awareness, but organizationally, These are diaries I've seen before.
Absolutely. It wasn't necessarily for the diaries. I think actually the diaries themselves and the research, the diary is really useful. I think it's perhaps because she was locked into that let's call it method, that when it came to how do we make this practically relevant, the extension was, well, here's another kind of a checklist type of a thing, because the idea was you were already keeping diaries and she was proving that diaries were useful. And so these were sort of further plugs that just kind of hit you into that. One thing I just wanted to add, though, and while we're still on the subject of what's really, really useful as well, and again, timely, is in that way that she's very direct, and I appreciate her for that. She also almost in the final section ends with this idea as well of the importance of the long term. And I think this is so important. Again, idea that there's that action reaction, short-termism. We are incentivized to be short-termist. We're incentivized to be quick wind. And we know this through the work of Robert Jackall and others. That kind of Jeffrey Pfeffer, high visibility of people, which quick wins facilitates, that short-term turnaround orientation, is how people get promoted, right? So what she says is if you are in these managerial roles, you might be both, you might prefer and be incentivized to be short-termist in your thinking, in your diary organization, in your prioritization, because this is what really she's trying to get at. She doesn't use it, but she's trying to get to how do you prioritize and on what basis. But she doesn't have the facility to answer the why question, right? But she's getting to that point. But what she highlights very strongly, and it's on the last page of the text, is, you know, immediate demands should not be satisfied at the expense of long-term aims. It's incredible. This is something that, you know, talking to any CEO today, and I've shadowed some very, very, closely, this is a perennial concern. And it's not just a concern for CEOs. Think about, you know, how we organize our work in an everyday sense, right?
Well, yeah, and she's very clear about that when she starts out the chapter, which I thought was a great way to do it. We're talking about defining your job, right, and what the objectives are. And that's where she makes her initial pitch in that chapter about, you know, pursuing the right objectives and don't neglect the long term for the short term. And I love the fact that she comes back to that, as Maya points out, because it is so seductive to, because you feel like you're making progress and you're doing things. And so it feels good. And I know this as a senior leader, a lot of these short-term things feel good because you can cross something off your list, something you work on for 6 months or a year or 2 years. Those are a little bit harder to get motivated about. But as Maya said, they're really important to organizations. And sometimes only the senior leader can work on them or at least direct resources to them. So that's one of those big challenges I used to ask myself when I was doing some self-analysis as a leader, is what are the kinds of things that I'm the only one in the organization or I'm the best suited to work on? What are those kinds of things? And I tried really hard not to be doing other people's what I would call day jobs and focus on the things that I was uniquely positioned or perhaps because of talent or capability, skills able to do, as opposed to the stuff that lots of people could do.
So perhaps as we wrap up part two, we can think about for part three, how do we answer that question of how do we get managers to think more long term?
Yep, I think that's great. So I think that we've had a great discussion and conversation in part two. And thank you for listening. And that's all for part two of episode 52. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we'd love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.